What kind of law do you practice?
Maritime law.
On what grounds could you possibly prevail?
Grounds? Who cares about grounds? Cases always come down to who the jury likes better.
Mr. Foley, I must warn you that if you attempt to belly rag or bulldoze this witness, I shall take very dim view of it.
Your lordship is most pretty.
Very well, then you may proceed.
Cash settlement. I could have figured that out, you button-down maggot!
You have any cream?
Oh, yes, of course. Where are my manners?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 369. I'm Thomas Smith. That's Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am doing fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great.
Yeah. Coronavirus free.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing wrong. Yeah. With the way. I don't have to worry about having a retirement account anymore. That's cool. Yeah. That's what load off my mind.
Yeah, we're going to work till we're 200 to take care of this. Yep. Numerologically, it's episode 369, so, you know, powers of 3. That's a good, you know.
That's kind of cool.
That's all I got.
That's all. Yeah. No, there's not much bright side to the world right now. But a little bit in today's episode, in which we will be discussing an update on the Led Zeppelin Spirit. We can never remember. Spirit Taurus.
Taurus is the song. Spirit is the band.
Yeah, I'll never keep that straight. So update on that lawsuit, but also an interview with David Williamson of the Central Florida Freethought community about a lawsuit. I don't want to spoilers, but there's possibly some discrimination against atheists and other religions, by the way, going on. And there was a whole lawsuit. It was a whole thing. We're going to talk to David about that. So why don't we get David on the line and interview him about what went down in Brevard County, Florida. Okay, here we go. Let's get David on the line. And we are on with David Williamson, director of the Central Florida Freethought community. How are you doing, David?
I'm great. Good to talk to you guys.
You as well. So what did we, Andrew, why don't you tee us up for the lawsuit we're discussing today?
Yeah, I wanted to have David on to discuss the finally settled. This is now I believe, over 4 years in the making lawsuit in Brevard County in Florida involving invocations before the Brevard Board of County Commissioners. And David, you want to tell us a little bit about the lawsuit, and then we'll work through the legal issues.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'm definitely not an attorney, but been a plaintiff for long enough to have a bit of a clue. So 5 years, 9 months, and 10 days at last count. So,
but who's counting?
So the before the Greece decision came out, the one that said prayers are okay at local government meetings, but even atheists are allowed to participate. At least those were the facts in the Greece, New York case. We were geared
and
up,
that is. Oh, and yeah, let me just jump in. That is, listeners of the show will recognize Town of Greece versus Galloway, which is a 2014 Supreme Court opinion. We've had Andrew Seidel from FFRF on a bunch of times to talk about it. It really is kind of a terrible gateway opinion in terms of teeing up the accommodationist view on the Supreme Court, which by my eye has at least 5 and possibly 7 adherents. And the idea is, you know, that there's this whole separation of church and state thing. But like, I mean, it's not like starting a prayer before a government meeting is actually religious or anything. So,
yeah. Isn't it like, oh, it's just for all the weird religions that you can't do that stuff. Doesn't that tend to be what the goes on?
And the non-religions as well. Yeah.
Exactly. With that explanation of Greece out of the way, go ahead.
Thanks for that, and I trust you'll keep our listeners up on anything that I kind of hand wave inappropriately. So we were ready when that decision came out. We had actually already studied our local kind of legislative prayer landscape and nailed down on 20 different local government meetings where this was happening, half a dozen where it wasn't. So once that decision came out, we sent out 20 letters, give or take one or two that went out a little bit later and said, hey, we ought to be involved in this. Let us know when we can do it. And most everybody got back. Some of them took several months. And Brevard actually took a couple of months to get a second letter from us. And then they voted 5-0 to say, nope, you can't do this. You can do your thing during the public comment period, which is the secular portion of our business. So let me
just jump in. When you say got a letter from you, describe the contents of that letter. Tell our listeners what you asked Brevard County to do.
Sure. Well, we had help from the Freedom From Religion Foundation's attorneys, as well as the American Humanist Association's Apagnani Humanist Legal Center in crafting that letter. And it basically said, we understand this decision gives us the right to participate. We were, obviously hoping that it would not, but it did. So our letter said, we deserve an opportunity to do this. When can we do it? As opposed to even asking. And that was what the letter had said, and we got good responses mostly.
And so tell me what a secular or humanist invocation would look like.
Well, so there's definitely a lot of examples of this, and we've been cataloging them from around the country on our website at cflfreethought.org. But basically, we include everyone in that opportunity. It's very much in the spirit of a prayer, so to speak, in that we call on everybody in the room to be the guidance and the wisdom, and the choices that we make should be guided by reason, and balanced based on the needs of the community. You know, we basically are giving a quick pep talk in a way like a prayer, and it sounds like a prayer to some people because we use some of the similar language, but we don't invoke a God. We invoke the people that are there to help do the business, as opposed to somebody on high through divine intervention.
Mm-hmm. And when you say you do this, I mean, how common, right? Like I'm sort of trying to throw potential other objections at you of, oh, is this a stunt? Is this just kind of, a weird way of trying to bring it down? How common are, secular invocations that, that sort of call upon the folks who are there?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by common, but we've done almost 100 now in the last 5 years across Central Florida, and there's probably been close to 100 more across the country as well. This has been a big part of our advocacy and really stepped up our game when it comes to our interfaith involvement as well as our political involvement. Local leaders and staff members of the cities and counties where we participate have thanked us, sometimes publicly, sometimes privately. But, there's still 95%+ of the invocations in our area are Protestant Christian prayers.
Yeah, no, that it's why I use that word as opposed to, majority or, plurality or something like that. But that certainly seems like a reasonably frequent occurrence, right? Like, again, not in the realm of what I would call, a one-off or a stunt or something like that. So understanding that that's what a secular invocation is, you send out these 20 letters. Most of the counties in Florida are receptive to that because, you said you've given about 100. How did Brevard take it?
Well, to clarify our scope a little bit, we serve about 5 counties generally and usually more broadly for issues that people bring our way because we're the state's only chapter of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So we do get traffic from a lot of different folks, but the 5 counties around Central Florida where this has been focused, Brevard being one of them, and the balance of those, the other 15 or so, and that number's gone a little higher lately, are towns and cities where we do this as well, where they have legislative prayers. But I do want to point out we don't participate in school board prayer. We still think that those are inappropriate, so we don't participate in those. In fact, we report those for letters to the attorneys.
Okay, understood, and I agree with that decision. And just to unpack that a little bit, the argument is in light of Town of Greece versus Galloway, the Supreme Court has said that opening legislative meetings with an invocation does not violate the Establishment Clause for reasons. and so I agree 100% with the division of the strategy that says we're going to read Town of Greece v. Galloway narrowly as applying to legislative sessions and not applying as the other side often does. They read that decision as saying, no, this means any kind of public meeting we can now open with prayer, and that's not a big deal. And I think there are very good textual reasons within the opinion, and also really good practical reasons to differentiate between a legislative session and a school board session. The principal one being that virtually every school board session will have a student member, right? And so your audience is very different, and certainly I think Town of Greece v. Galloway was wrongly decided, but operating in a universe in which that exists, you could see the difference between speaking to an audience full of adults in a sectarian way versus speaking to an audience that often includes, you know, children as young as 12. So that's the reason for, I think that's the reason for drawing a distinction. It certainly is the reason I would, and I would endorse, you know, saying, hey, look, we're not going to legitimate the strategy of saying that Town of Greece applies to school board meetings.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. And they, anyway, keep going.
Yeah. And they also, no problem. And I appreciate the clarity you bring to the conversation always. So the Brevard didn't respond well. So they had one meeting where they said, you know, after the second letter we sent, you cannot do this. And then actually the Anti-Defamation League sent a letter after that and said, everyone needs to be able to do this. You should allow this. And they voted 5-0 the second time to not allow this. And that's when we were already working with attorneys to go ahead and develop something here. We have five plaintiffs and three local organizations who were already working on building the facts of the case.
Well, can I drill down? And again, I just find this really fascinating to get into the specific details. So the ADL filed a letter or sent a letter as well. Had you been working with them as well prior to that point, or was that just a lucky coincidence of goals?
Right. No, we did not know David Barkey, the attorney that works in Florida for the Anti-Defamation League, and when that happened. And certainly we reached out right after that and connected with him and have been collaborating on other issues with him since then. But no, that was a refreshing surprise at the time.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So the following year, the county was in communication with the attorneys on our team that were building the case. And then the attorneys were building the case with us at the time when they passed a resolution, which we anticipated because we monitor the agendas of these meetings. And that's I like to say it's a 66.6 page resolution that said why we couldn't participate, pointing to humanist writings and atheist writings and how, you know, many people have advocated against religion and anti-theistic opinions out of the organizations that were involved locally and nationally. So they were basically saying you can't participate in this process because you're anti-religious. And of course there's anti-religious people in the humanist and atheist community, and there's anti-Catholic people in the Protestant community, but you know, those arguments certainly don't hold water.
If I understand correctly, they basically went through and cherry picked atheist authors and said, oh, you're hostile to religion, so you're not welcome to participate?
Exactly. And it even, the facts even got a little bit more fascinating when we did our depositions.
Couldn't you pick for any religion? You can probably find people that are very hostile toward other religions if you pick the right writings.
Absolutely. There's always somebody who's miffed about somebody else, and there's religious lines crossed all the time in that. So it was kind of amusing, and I don't think that actually held water. And one of the arguments that they had in response to the filing was that religious people were in the minority in Brevard County, and they used church attendance to justify this.
That seems like a
But they just so happen to have five representatives or whatever that 5-0 keep doing these unanimous decisions against you. What are the odds?
Yeah, exactly. So I thought there would be enough scientists, enough rocket scientists in the Space Coast to turn the tide towards secularism. But it is a relatively conservative constituency there in the county.
Yeah. Okay, so you get turned down. They pass a resolution that says What exactly? Yeah, I was going to say, what exactly does it say?
Yeah, it says
Thomas says separate but equal.
That's right, that's certainly an argument that we used when we were talking to the media and others about this case. It's pretty much what they said. You can use the water fountain in the public comment portion of the meeting, not the prayer portion of the meeting. That's for the religious community to do that. And they actually said, because we were non-theists, and I don't know the particular language off the top of my head, but because we didn't believe in God, we couldn't do that. And the depositions made it even more clear how concerned they were about outsiders, not just from the non-theist community.
So when you say outsiders, tell me what you mean by that.
Well, so they basically favored monotheism in their depositions generally, and certainly Christianity. They showed aversion to anything they didn't understand as far as a religion, participating in the process. They definitely demonstrated some ignorance of other faith traditions, and it was quite clear their motivations at that point.
Well, I snuck ahead by asking you a question about depositions that implies that a lawsuit took place. So I take it that was not long in coming after they announced a specific policy excluding non-clergy from participating in the invocation.
Absolutely. I mean, we had the heads up that what this resolution looked like because of the requirement to put these items into an agenda. And we had that walking into the meeting. The actual lawsuit was filed the day of the meeting. As soon as they voted in favor of that, we filed, spoke to the media, announced it, and we were off and running. So that was in July 2015.
Well, and I don't know if we want to talk about this now, but in terms of, and one of the reasons that I wanted to have you come on the show is in talking about activism, you know, particularly in the age of Trump and in the age where, you know, we're sort of looking at a hostile Supreme Court and a hostile judiciary. And I thought that the tale of the success is, you know, we like to try and cover things that aren't always terrible news all the time and sort of help give blueprints and hope to our listeners. But so with that as kind of an introduction, do you have a thought, or do we want to cover it later, on sort of the change in the environment between, you know, the way you might have been feeling as a secular activist in 2015 versus today?
Absolutely. But along with it, you know, the other variable here is what I've learned since getting involved over 10 years ago in the community. But mm-hmm. we see a lot of problems, and we do see some failures of our activism to succeed. We don't often hear about the positive resolutions. So sometimes there are responses to complaints, you know, simply conversations or letters, and those don't make the news as often as the complaints themselves. When they are favorable, the news isn't quite so interested in it as if the conflict is resolved, right? They're about conflict, not resolution.
Talk to us a little bit about that, like in terms of, you know, how often do you see, you know, obviously, again, we've had Andrew on and he's talked about their successes in just, you know, writing letters to school districts that have, you know, prayers or, you know, otherwise sort of inappropriate religious content. Talk a little bit about some of the successes we haven't seen. I know I'm taking down a rabbit trail, but you had to know that was coming on the show.
So. No, that's great. And Andrew's been a big advocate and ally for us since he came on board the Freedom From Religion Foundation, I guess about 8 years ago. He was the Florida attorney, of his other states as well. He was our primary attorney in Florida for several years. Although we haven't had the success in Florida that we've had around the country, there's certainly some breakdowns in communications and some potential lawsuits already in Florida because we failed to succeed in particularly Central Florida. But there are other parts of the state where we've had some success stories. And we see on a good year, or I guess I should say a bad year, about 100 complaints or questions that come in from around the state just in our local organization. And they see hundreds more that go to the national organization that we don't see. So it's pretty significant numbers. People don't know their rights or ask questions. And certainly that number would be a lot higher in rural parts of the state, where I think non-theists are going to be much more oppressed.
Yeah. And most of those are resolved amicably?
No, and I guess that's your original question. So, no, certainly not. Most of them are either unaddressed because the facts aren't clear enough to send a letter. Hardly any litigation. We've had very few lawsuits in Florida, and you've heard about them all, generally filed in federal court. But no, most of those are not favorable, but many of them are also questions that we answer and understand. But we also build, you know, a log of complaints with particular counties and work towards resolution. And in particularly Central Florida, Seminole and Orange County, we've got a backlog of unresolved issues. So we are, you know, we're seeking plaintiffs to work in those two counties right now.
Okay. Well, and that's good that you're collecting that information and sort of developing the strategy. So let me apologize for derailing you a little bit. Let's get back on. You file the lawsuit. You have depositions in which you obtain, you know, what I would say is, you know, proverbial smoking gun testimony, and head off to federal U.S. District Court in the Central District of Florida in Orlando, and talk a little bit about that, right? Was there some sort of trepidation heading into it on the judge draw? You know, what were your thoughts?
Certainly, we had a great legal team. Alex Luchinitzer from Americans United kept us abreast of the situation throughout the process. And I want to mention the other local organizations, the Humanist Community, the Space Coast, and the Space Coast Freethought Association. We went in this clear-eyed and understanding that we might not get a victory, that we certainly weren't looking to win any money or any fame, but we felt like that the facts were right. It's certainly in that 11th Circuit Court when we started in 2015, things looked better than they do now. But I think we were pretty excited about the opportunity. This was the first lawsuit of this type for most everybody involved. We had a previous lawsuit here in Orange County, public schools, but it was exciting, but as you know, painfully slow, right? The process took a year and a half before we even had a hearing, which also was quite interesting to see a hearing, but it was not with witnesses. You know, the facts in the case were not in dispute. So that was in September of 2016.
Yeah, and that was a summary judgment?
That's right, right. Yeah, I suspect that's correct. You know, the facts were not in dispute. Both of the attorneys just basically stated their cases, and the many, many months later, we heard back again. I think it was over a year.
And then?
Yeah, so the we won in December 2017, or excuse me, rather, October 2017, we won the Judge Antoon in the Middle District Court in Central Florida, ruled in our favor on nearly everything. The only thing we didn't win on, and the claim was, of course, that we should have a right to participate. The one thing we didn't win on was the request to stand, which is as you may know, has gone back and forth over the years. Is, you know, compelling people to stand is often used as a way to describe how it makes somebody who doesn't want to participate feel. If my attorney would walk into a courtroom with me, they would probably advise that I stand for the pledge. And even if there was an illegal prayer, they would probably advise me to stand so that I didn't stand out. So this is why standing is a problem.
Yeah. Well, and I want to clarify, because obviously we use the term standing a lot on the show. Yeah. But so the challenge was to the provision of how the invocation was being implemented that required participants in the room to stand respectfully. And I understood your argument to be that the requirement of physically standing up was itself a form of establishment under the First Amendment. And that issue you lost on at the district court level while prevailing on the larger issue of inclusion in light of Town of Greece versus Gallup.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. And okay. Another word that is interesting in this case is we actually had a prayer to the court about secular invocations, which, you know, obviously we're not prayers. So that's an interesting word choice in that light as well. So we found that at least amusing as non-attorneys. So
I write prayer for relief in all of my complaints. So I'm with you. I do twinge a little bit every time. But okay. So you win in late 2017. Brevard County appeals the ruling to the 11th Circuit. Was there some thought, and did you make an effort to kind of reach out to the county to say, you know, hey, the longer you participate in this process, right, the costlier it's going to be for your citizen. You know, was there a thought that maybe they might, you know, just sort of take their lumps and go back and change the policy?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that. It reminded me, and I don't remember when the attorney, the original county attorney that was involved initially left the county, but he has since retired. I understand he was the only county attorney in the nation to file a friend of the court brief in favor of the town of Greece in the decision. So we definitely knew who we were up against, and I don't know when he left, but they were in it for the seemingly at the long haul. And I wasn't privileged to the communications that happened between the attorneys, but I'm sure they discussed that it would be costly, and they certainly knew it would be to appeal. But, you know, it turns out that they're not really spending the county's money. This is insurance money. So I guess it's everybody who pays into those premiums for that insurance company that are paying for this. That was unfortunate, but you know, even if it was the county's money, I don't think that the short-term view of the politicians and their perhaps conservative base would care as much about that as the principle of having the right to pray and certainly misunderstanding the Establishment Clause that way.
Yeah. So, okay. So the county appeals at the end of 2017, that appeal is going to be heard by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And which covers Florida, Alabama, and Georgia, right?
That's right.
It was split off from the old Fifth Circuit, and is again, you know, as you might imagine, considered one of the more conservative appellate courts in the country. What were your thoughts in prepping for that argument before the 11th Circuit?
So the attorneys had the ball and ran with it the entire way. You know, they used our facts in the case and certainly consulted with us to develop those. But you know, you're asking me the questions from the mind of an attorney into the mind of a plaintiff, so it's a little difficult to know the strategy. But I think they were, you know, sticking with the facts all along that this was clearly discrimination. And there was two Republican president appointees on the court, one of which was a Trump appointee. I don't have the names memorized. You can probably see them if you look up the case. But they actually asked questions that seemed, to favor our position, whereas the Democrat appointee, and I think that might have been an Obama appointee, asked questions that were, you know, unfavorable. But we were warned by both of the attorneys that were there, one from the ACLU of Florida, Dan Tilley, and also Alex at the time. Don't take that as any kind of indication. You know, I know attorneys are pretty good about not picking winners and losers based on the questions asked at the court. So, but it was exciting. We got to go down to Miami for that and you know, spend an hour trying to park. But it was a good day, and it was a enjoyable experience to see, you know, the justice system in action and actually be a part of it.
Well, I am a strong believer. I've made this position on the show several times. Andrew Seidel and I have gotten... have nearly come to blows on it that
the pronunciation
arguments...
of amicus or, oh no, sorry.
But that oral arguments are overrated. Now admittedly the counter argument was, you know, that he had attended the oral arguments in the why am I blanking on the name of the Missouri tire resurfacing playground.
Trinity Lutheran.
Yeah. Well, can we go back? Let's do that. Right. So,
I think we should let.
Yeah, leave that in. Right. That's fine.
Let's let David have that one.
Yeah.
Fair enough. David just pulled that. When you, the lawyer, and I, the person who's listened to several episodes about that, could not pull the name. Congrats, David.
We're going to leave it. We're not going to do an edit point on that. I blanked on Trinity Lutheran because I have attempted to block it out from my memory. But we walked through Trinity Lutheran on the briefs in an early 2016 segment on the show called You Be the Supreme Court, because I was so confident. I mean, the law is just abundantly clear that it had to go the other way. And Andrew came on and said, well, you know, the oral arguments went super bad for us. And that was the one, wasn't it?
Not even particularly close either.
Yeah, like, it was 7-2. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, that was bad.
That was fine.
So that's the argument that oral arguments do matter. I, again, you know, it sounds like in your case that, it was not a particularly ominous portent as to how that broke down. When the actual decision came down, right, in July of 2019, July 8th, I think, was the thing that I don't know is, did Brevard County appeal that to the Supreme Court?
They did not. They did not appeal that. No.
And typically, the reason in which you would sort of give up at that stage is if you think that the underlying facts are really not good as a vehicle for that kind of decision, mm-hmm. right? I cut over the punchline because obviously if Brevard County is appealing, you know what we know the result, which was that the 11th Circuit upheld the district court's decision on appeal. Any additional thoughts about that?
Well, so they did send it back, and I don't know if a remand was the type of language to use for this, but they did send it back to clarify a few things, and then of course the attorneys went back and forth on the terms of that agreement, as well as some other details with the case. But no, it was in just February that we actually had the settlement voted, which is interesting, 5-0 again, but this time to stop wasting the time and money of the taxpayers. And some of the money that was paid did come out of the pocket of the county, and not all of it was paid by the insurance company. And that certainly caught the attention of some local folks, particularly those that are fiscally conservative and concerned about how the county's money is spent.
Right. Well, and then let me be specific about the portion that was sent back on remand. Mm. So the ultimate holding of the case, and I should add that, you know, this was a 3-0 panel. There was no dissent,
right.
but what the 11th Circuit held was that in light of Town of Greece versus Galloway, that Brevard County may allow a sectarian prayer at the start of its legislative sessions, but that the selection process can't be discriminatory under the First Amendment. And that because of the total discretion vested mm-hmm. here, and in light of the kinds of testimony that was elicited that said, yeah, basically we were explicitly going to restrict this to clergy. And as you pointed out, not excluding not only humanist organizations, but potentially other religions as well, that was not permissible in light of the rationale. And so what they remand on for fact finding, I'll read a little bit from the opinion where it says, we need not and do not reach any further questions presented in this case, including whether the county is obliged to allow the individual or organizational plaintiffs, atheists and secular humanists, the opportunity to deliver an invocation at the start of one of its board meetings. So in other words, the 11th Circuit wasn't, they said you won, but they were saying, look, we don't know what a fair process would look like and if that fair process would include the rights of atheists and secular humanists to deliver the invocations. Mm-hmm. Now, you can read between the lines and guess where they would come out. But that's what they remand back to the district court for further fact finding to say, okay, so let's get a real process together, and then, you know, sometimes you have, in light of this, a legislative body may try and take another swing at it, right? Mm-hmm. And say, okay, well, you know, now we're going to have, you know, we're going to do it by lot or, you know, whatever.
Right. Is that common for, first let me say that I did notice that you as a good attorney asked me questions that you already knew the answers to. So good on you for that. But also, is it common for the courts to not say, well, here's what you could have done that would have been legitimate? Is that very common or uncommon for that to be the case? Because I wonder if Satanists or you know, Native Americans or, you know, any other particular minority religion that would not necessarily be in favor, would they be able to reach a better decision because of who they are and being theistic? I mean, and I know I'm asking you to speculate a little bit, but it seems that's odd to me that they didn't rule on that.
So That's a great question, and let me kind of parse out what I think the two principles that apply here are. The first is the legal concept of standing, right? So not the actual physical activity of rising, but one of the things that courts take very seriously is the idea that they are going to award the relief that is appropriate on the facts of this case and not speculate out as to other potential cases, right. Even if that would apply on the facts of the people in front of you. Okay. And I realize there's a little bit of that may be a little bit confusing. So let me try and make that specific. In this case, the legal question that was presented to the 11th Circuit was, are the current processes as put into place 5-0 by the Brevard Board of County Commissioners, do they discriminate unconstitutionally in a way that violates the First Amendment in the speaker selection process? And once they rule yes, right, their job is kind of done, mm-hmm. right? Those processes are bad. And so anything beyond that that says, oh, and by the way, if you did it this way, it would probably be okay. Courts do that sometimes, and that part of the opinion is called dicta, right? Which is to say, it is not the holding; it is part of speculation. And sometimes, you know, that speculation is more closely tied than others, right? Certainly, you know, a great many cases have kind of a binary outcome, right? And so, if you say, you know, not A is an impermissible outcome, well, I would say, as a lawyer, I might say that strongly suggests that A is the right outcome. Mm-hmm. As a logician, you might say, well, okay, look, that means A is the outcome, right? So that's sort of the first is that all of your appellate courts, all of your federal courts in general, are going to be sensitive to the idea of standing and confining their ruling to awarding the relief that was sought by the plaintiffs that are before it. The second is kind of a more general principle is that appellate courts in particular love the idea of saying, well, we're not going to decide, right? We're called upon to decide the law. We're not going to decide any facts. And so if there's anything that's missing at all from the record, we will remand it back down to the district court for future fact finding. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that remand, you know, as in this case, you can sort of see the writing on the wall, but sometimes it really is like you can win, get all the way up, you know, to a circuit court of appeal or even the Supreme Court. And then your victory could result in going down and a fact finding process that still excludes you from the actual tangible thing that you want done down the line.
Right.
So that is a real risk. So hopefully that answered your question to me, which, by the way, not nice of coming on as the guest on the show and taking over the interviewing role. So,
well, we all long to hear you talk legalese to us and square it away so we can understand it and we appreciate that. So hopefully that was useful. I will say this, that during the process of the nomination to the Supreme Court during our case, we were all very aware and even communicating about the idea that we were less and less interested in this going to the Supreme Court while that was happening. So this is a real change in the way I think the attorneys at the national levels of the organizations that we work with look at whether these cases will be litigated in any federal courts, right? So they're probably thinking more about state courts in some cases. So.
Yeah, well, and that I think that's an excellent segue into sort of the drawing this to a close, that it's still possible to be in a conservative part of the country, headed to a conservative appeals court, and prevail on a First Amendment claim seeking equal participation on behalf of atheists, secular humanists, and non-believers. And that really, I mean, that it should be inspiring to people who are listening to this show to know, you know, we cover a lot of bad stuff. We cover a lot
It should also be the bare minimum, but yeah.
Well, that's fair.
Guys, are you excited that you get equal protection under the law, even though there's a bunch of like religious, you know, bigots that are in charge? And it's like, yeah, I guess I'm excited, but
yeah.
I don't
exactly.
know. It seems like the bare minimum.
Right. Well, we have our shot, and right now they're in a moment of silence in Brevard, and if they, you know, we're monitoring that agenda, and if they choose to change that policy, we will be involved in making sure that they don't discriminate against us or anybody else. And I do want to point out that the legal landscape around this issue with two other cases that actually started and finished at generally the same time, you know, Barker v. Conroy in the D.C. Circuit and Fields versus Speaker of the Pennsylvania House as well. I mean, you know, those two cases did not go in our favor as folks that are looking to have opportunities to participate in these invocations.
And so, you know, what that really does is, I mean, that sets up a split among the circuits. How did, I don't know if, I mean, this is more of a legal question, but do you view those cases as being distinguishable on the facts or being more my take, essentially the same facts, but coming to an opposite result?
Well, interestingly, and we didn't talk about this because there's a lot of nuance in all of these things, particularly when you compare Marsh at the state legislature versus Greece at the local town meetings. Think about the participants, as you talked about with the students being at school board meetings. We are involved in these meetings at the local level. There's not people participating from the audience at either the state or federal legislatures, right? So the facts are certainly different there. And I think that, you know, the details matter and the facts are unique in each case. And you understand that, and other people who pay attention to this do. So in the case of local government meetings, I hope that this decision is important across the country. It's, you know, still just the 11th Circuit, but that Third Circuit decision for Pennsylvania and the D.C. Circuit is still, you know, related to state legislatures, and in the case of Barker v. Conroy, the U.S. House of Representatives. So yeah, I don't know how that bodes well or not for others, but certainly at the local level, we've got a good victory here.
Well, and I think that's kind of a great way to bring this to a conclusion. Thomas, I don't know if you had any other questions you wanted to ask.
Sounds good. Really appreciate you coming on and giving us the breakdown. And yeah, just, it's kind of frustrating because it feels like none of this should exist to me, but because it exists, then therefore also don't discriminate against atheists. You know, like, I don't understand why, can these people just do their jobs without having to pray first? That's what I want to know.
That's right. There's a lot of good meetings to participate in these, or excuse me, a lot of good reasons to participate in these invocation practices. So I don't want to go into that now, but being there puts a face on who we are in the eye of the public, and particularly getting people to stand at attention and listen to humanist values being talked about is a positive thing. So this isn't all bad.
I guess. I don't know. It's just like, everyone listening who has a job, do you need to pray before you do your damn job, or are you able to just do it? That's what I want to know. But sorry, that's just personal editorializing. I agree with what you're saying.
No, but I also like David's point of there's actually pretty robust academic research on discrimination against atheists. The reason I can pull this up is because my son used this in one of his debate cases. It was super cool. And some minority groups, right, when they are more visible, it's the question of visibility, right? And discrimination against some minority groups increases with increased visibility. With atheism, the data is overwhelming that increasing atheist visibility decreases discrimination, increases the trust variables, right? Like it literally is like all of the academic research conclude that the best thing you can do is sort of follow the similar strategy from the gay rights movement in terms of just increasing the visibility of atheists in the public square. That's why I publicly identify as one, you know, why we do that on our show and, you know, have guests on there. So I think I agree with David that, having a humanist stand up and like not be weird is a victory for us. So,
well, we even let the weird ones participate, you know. But
do your best to not be weird.
We help write invocations when necessary.
I mean, you know, weird from my perspective. So, as somebody who delights in reading, 900 pages of law review articles and cases every week, I live in the glassiest of glass houses on that. So,
all right. Well, David Williamson, thanks so much for joining us. Do you want to toss out any plugs? If anybody wants to get involved or anything?
So I would say we've got a robust community across Florida, and you can find out more about the communities across the state by going to our website at cflfreethought.org and looking for our allies and other groups page. We want to get folks in Florida connected and not so we can just litigate, but also so we can socialize, volunteer, and get active in other ways. So come check us out.
Excellent. Thanks so much for joining us. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Editude. Folks, it is, it's not easy to get good sleep, just in general, for some people, myself included, and even more so lately, when there are so many things that may be beyond your control. But here's one thing that is in your control. It's getting the best sheets around, and those are Editude sheets. If you want to get the best sleep of your life, you've got to try these Editude sheets. First off, they are incredibly comfortable. They are super soft. There's one reviewer who said they feel like you're being cocooned by a zillion kittens. And that is exactly how I want to sleep, personally. So that's why I like them. And here's the most important thing for me. They're cooling. The fabric is extremely breathable. It regulates your temperature to improve your quality of sleep. There's nothing worse than waking up all sweaty and interrupting your great sleep that you're planning on getting. Not with Editude. The sheets are cool. So why not try Editude? These amazing sheets have a 30-day risk-free trial. If you're not fully satisfied, you can return your sheets for a full refund. They even cover shipping on returns. Editude is bedding for the educated, conscious consumer. It's 100% organic bamboo made with a non-toxic manufacturing process. It's hypoallergenic and antimicrobial. Editude sheets, they're soft as silk, breathable as linen, but at the price of cotton. You're going to love them. And right now, our listeners will get 20% off their sheet set and free shipping. Just text OA to 64,000. The only way to get 20% off your set of Editude sheets and free shipping is to text OA to 64,000. One more time, that's OA to 64,000.
Yeah, I can play the guitar. I know all about virtuosos and tremolos and arpeggios. I can do it all. I can play your basic rhythm guitar like jug jugga jug jugga jug jugga jug jugga jug jugga jug jug jugga 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 jug.
All right. Well, Andrew, just enough time for a I think for an update on this Led Zeppelin lawsuit. You've done it again. 2 for 2 wildcard segments.
Well, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to, you know, talk some Led Zepp here. We've done the past 2 weeks in a row talking about music law. People seem to enjoy it. I enjoy it. I know you enjoy it. So let's hit it. Just as a reminder, right, we've covered this. Episodes 236 and 288. And essentially what happened was Led Zeppelin won at trial in their in defending their lawsuit alleging copyright infringement by Randy California, the estate of Randy California of the band Spirit, in connection with their song Taurus, which Randy California's lawyers allege that the iconic central riff of Stairway to Heaven rips off their song Taurus. What happened was Led Zeppelin prevailed at trial, and then on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, Randy California won a major victory in front of the panel that we described in detail in those previous episodes. Led Zeppelin petitioned for en banc review, which was granted, and the entire Ninth Circuit reversed the panel opinion just a couple of days ago. And
now remind me, was that just on the jury instruction-y thingy, or
there were 6 or 7 issues, but the main issue that they reversed on was on the jury instruction. And in particular, it's an issue that is strongly implicated by our discussion last week, right, with Damien Real and Noah Rubin, on sort of the intuition of copying in what was called the inverse ratio rule. And so the inverse ratio rule is what it sounds like. It is a rule in the Ninth Circuit that says the stronger the evidence that one party had access to the work that is alleged to have been copyrighted, the less compelling the similarities between the two works need to be in order to give rise to an inference of copying.
Right.
And So what the full 11, what the full Ninth Circuit said was, that's no longer good law. So we're going to go through that kind of quickly. But first, I wanted to talk in a couple ways. So number one, right, you will see as we go through the 11th Circuit's opinion, I think part of the reason they reached this result has to do with the intuitions that we saw on the sort of pro, you know, a narrow view of copyright from Real and Rubin, right? And in a way, I think it validates the argument that I made in response to those guys, right? Which was basically like, I don't know that copyright needs to be changed with respect to music. It certainly needs to be changed with respect to the technology, right? We all agree on that. But I don't know that the equities of the situation require a change, because I think that sort of the case-by-case analysis covers a lot of the underlying intuitions that that Real and Rubin were talking about. But I'll leave that for folks to evaluate for themselves. I thought this is on pages 12 to 13. Obviously, we're going to link the opinion in the show notes. Pages 12 to 13 really summarize the underlying arguments at trial, and they summarize it so well in a way that's a little different than the panel opinion that I think it's worth pausing on, in particular because Randy California's expert really articulated what I would call the Thomas rule in terms of adjudicating copyright infringement for music, right? And so here's how the court describes what their expert, Alexander Stewart, said. He analyzed one by one five categories of similarities. Dr. Stewart acknowledged that a chromatic scale and arpeggios are common musical elements, but he found Taurus and Stairway to be similar because the descending chromatic scales in the two compositions skip the note E and return to the tonic pitch A, and the notes in the scale have the same durations. Yeah. Then he pointed to three two-note sequences, AB, BC, and CF sharp, that appear in both compositions. In his view, the presence of successive eighth-note rhythm in both compositions also made them similar. And finally, he testified that the two compositions have the same pitch collection, explaining that certain notes appear in the same proportions in the beginning sequences of both works. In sum, Dr. Stewart claimed that the five musical elements in combination were copied because those elements made Taurus unique and memorable, and those elements also appear in Stairway to Heaven. And to me, that sounded like the argument you've been making in connection with these cases. I know you came out the other way, right? But the argument is, yeah, it's not just ding, 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 right? It's not just copying the melody. Right?
Yeah, no, it definitely has to be more. Yeah, I mean, we can all agree, and we all agreed the other week that like that what's her name case is just ridiculous. Like I still don't know.
Katy Perry, yeah.
Katy Perry, yeah. This is no Katy Perry. Like this is definitely, this case had more, you know, prima facie validity, in my opinion, than that Katy Perry thing or the Blurred Lines one, which was even worse.
Lines was also a Ninth Circuit opinion. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. We got this comment from Jacob, who says, "I could take the line, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, and replace the parts of speech with different words and produce the line, he was the smartest of men, he was the dumbest of men. That would not be subject to copyright infringement." And I think he's probably right on that.
Yeah.
Because it's just the grammar, right? The stylistic pattern of pronoun, verb, article, adjective, preposition, noun can't be copyrighted. How is this different from copying the melodic pattern of a song and just replacing the notes or chords? And obviously we don't have time to fully unpack that, but I thought that was a good...
I don't know if that is a good comparison, because if you change the key of a song, that does absolutely nothing to protect you. You know, because it's totally recognizable still. You know, if I play, I keep going back to Hey Jude or whatever the song is, Yesterday. If I just transpose it however many semitones, you know, you're going to fully, most people can't even tell that you've done that actually. So I don't know the comparison there, like if that holds up between the text and music.
Understood. I liked the analogy. So I think what you're saying there is that might come off as just the shifting might come off as, you know, it was the best of times, it was the blurst of times, right? Like it would be a very minor or perhaps indetectable.
It's more like
change.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. No,
got it. Yeah. Having Mickey Mouse or Ricky Rouse. Sorry. In any event.
Well, no, I mean, the reason I compare it to what you're saying, no, I compare it to Jacob. Was it Jacob? To yeah. Jacob's example, because if you transpose a work that we all would know and love, transpose it, you know, let's say one step up, you know, one whole note up or whatever. Those are all that you've changed every note, like you've changed it all. Those are all different notes, but it's the relationships between them that we all recognize.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And again, I think my larger point in quoting Stewart here is I think it articulated what I would consider to be right the Thomas rule,
like a more holistic approach to the composition rather than just the melody.
Yep, exactly. And then here's what Ferrara said, and I don't know that this corresponds to what Reel and Rubin were talking about, but Ferrara said that the two compositions are completely distinct. And first, he showed the difference in the written sheet music, right? This is why the deposit copy was so important as opposed to the copy
still
that was performed.
Still don't fully get that. But
okay. I don't get that at all. And, you know, we can talk about that when we return to music. As somebody who doesn't read music, right? You put up the...
Well, were we able to finally get our hands on these copies and what they're talking about? Because I wasn't, you know, it could all depend on however somebody wrote it out. Like,
yeah,
there was no way to know for sure without seeing what they're talking about.
So there still isn't a complete copy of the deposit copy, but, and this is not surprising, the deposit copy is like it's described in the 11th Circuit opinion as a single sheet of paper. Right. And so it's not surprising. I mean, you know, in the version we heard, you know, that was the concert version was like 4 minutes long and kind of meandering. And again, it's not hard to imagine that, you know, they started playing a different version at concerts because that's what bands do. Right. And so.
And remind me, is that this is the deposit copy of Taurus?
Of Taurus. Yes.
Okay.
So. Led Zeppelin's expert says, first, just look at the sheet music. It's totally different. And then he says, and in terms of the claimed similarities, they either involve unprotectable common musical elements or they're random. For example,
random?
Dr. Ferrara explained that the similarity in the three two-note musical sequences is not musically significant because in each song, the sequences were preceded and followed by different notes to form distinct melodies. He described that purported similarity based on those note sequences as akin to arguing that the words crab and absent are similar words because they both have the letter pair AB. I don't know that I bought that argument. In terms of that being a fair comparison, because again, you know, the analogy from parts of speech to music is, I think, not quite.
I think what he's getting at might be when I talked about the top line that mm-hmm. that Stairway to Heaven has the dun, 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 dun. Like that's right. Different. Like the first, I remember the Spirit song. Is just more the bass part. It's just dum 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 dum. And so maybe he's saying like, when rather than just looking at those common notes, you put the whole Stairway to Heaven one as one thing, rather than just isolating those lower notes that I think are in common with both the songs. Actually, I think I agree with that. I think that's kind of similar to the point I made because the top notes that are in Stairway to Heaven do actually kind of change even the chord a little bit. And add something that's not in the Spirit song.
Okay, so those were the positions advanced at trial, and the as we have discussed, and as we discussed with David Williamson in the main interview segment, you don't appeal on the facts, you appeal on the law. And the there were a whole bunch of legal issues that were raised by Randy California in appealing to the Ninth Circuit. But the key one was the failure to give a jury instruction on the inverse ratio rule, which we're going to get to. But one of the other things, but as we get to that, I promise that's next. I also want to point out on page nine, a longstanding opening arguments position, which is courts are always considering fairness. And it's something I've said a lot, and it's something that you saw Reel and Rubin say, well, look, there's going to be this technical application, and, you know, there are four notes of similarity, and that means that, you know, poor Katy Perry is going to get sued by everybody. And I just want to read this passage from page nine on the procedural history, which says, Wolf, that's the name for Randy California, that's his given name, passed away in 1997. After his death, Wolf's mother established the Randy Craig Wolf Trust and served as the trustee until she passed away. Neither Wolf nor his mother filed a lawsuit regarding Stairway to Heaven. Michael Skidmore became a co-trustee of the trust in 2006. Fast forward 43 years from the release of Stairway to Heaven to May 2014, one may wonder how a suit so long in the making could survive a latches defense. And latches, we've brought up this word before. It's an equitable defense. That means unreasonable delay, right? It means it's an assertion by the defendant that the plaintiff has also been negligent, in this case, negligent in asserting his or her legal rights. And so it kind of works as a common law statute of limitations, right? It says, look, right? If you thought you've heard Stairway to Heaven, right? Like, if you thought it infringed your song, maybe you should have sued us in 1971 or 1973. Yeah. But, you know, 2014 seems an awful long time away. And then the Ninth Circuit continues. The Supreme Court answered this question in Petrella versus Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, a 2014 case, which clarified that latches is not a defense where copyright infringement is ongoing. Okay, so in practical terms, that means, since I can turn on, you know, KWOLD, all oldies all the time, which, by the way, would be a station I would totally listen to, and hear Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, that means that the infringement is ongoing, so there's no latches defense. That's also how you get around statute of limitations. It's a little weird, right? Like, I could see a distinction that says, yeah, statutes of limitation do not toll when the injury is ongoing, but the equitable defense, you know, does. I could see that result, but nevertheless, the Supreme Court said that latches is not a defense to ongoing copyright infringement. So you can see the Ninth Circuit kind of saying, like, all right, we got to take this case seriously, but, you know, we're not happy about it. We think that there's some inequity. And so it's not surprising then that you know, they've kind of looked for a way to reach the other result. And now at long last, we get to the inverse ratio rule. I described it. I will tell you that in many ways, right? First, the inverse ratio rule, the idea that the stronger the evidence of access, the less evidence you need of similarity, has some intuitive appeal, right?
Yeah.
Even
seems right to me.
Yeah, right. So here's what the court, right? And again, we went through this with Reel and Rubin, right? Like, it, the versus, you know, the baby kind of crying a potential Katy Perry melody, which strikes me as not implausible, that, you know, you would say, all right, I'd need an awful lot of similarity to believe that Katy Perry stole the melody from a baby, as opposed to stole it from, you know, those rappers. But then the Ninth Circuit says, consider some problems with this rule. And they said, and note, by the way, this is a rule of interpretation. It's not in the statute, right? The copyright law does not say the more you prove access, the less you have to prove similarity. This is just a way of getting at the fundamental question that I described, which is, given that a copyright infringer is going to say, no, I created this simultaneously and it's just a coincidence, how do you disprove that assertion, Right. The Ninth Circuit comes up with three arguments against the inverse ratio rule from a public policy perspective.
You know what? Maybe you didn't leave enough time for this.
We'll go quickly. All right. So first, they say, what does access really mean in an age of SoundCloud, right? Like we're quickly, from a technological perspective, moving to a position where everybody has access to everything.
Yeah, back in the day, like how were you going to hear Taurus and Spirit or whatever unless you literally were touring with them? Like,
yeah, well, which you kind of were.
Which they were. No, which I'm saying, like that's a more, but nowadays everyone basically has access to every single thing. Because it's all on the internet. So I guess that makes sense.
Yep. That was point one. Point two is also this rule seems to work in the middle as a gut check. But if you take it to its logical extreme, it becomes nonsense, right? So if I have complete access to a song, but I have no similarity between my song, right? Like that wouldn't be infringement at all.
Well, you wouldn't set it at zero. Yeah. Like you'd set it where you need some base level of similarity. And then from there,
Yeah. I think this is their weakest argument, but you know, they point it out. And then their third argument, which I hadn't considered before, is it also seems unfair. And here, this is from page 32 of the opinion, and I'm just going to quote it. To the extent access still has meaning, the inverse ratio rule unfairly advantages those whose work is most accessible by lowering the standard of proof for similarity. Thus, the rule benefits those with highly popular works. And then they could go off. I guess the judge's clerk was a fan of The Office, right? That's like The Office, which are also highly accessible. But nothing in copyright suggests that a work deserves stronger legal protection simply because it is more popular or owned by better funded rights holders. And I think that's not a bad argument either. And then I won't go through this. The Ninth Circuit does say, gives, and I would encourage everybody to read this because we talk about stare decisis on the show all the time and how the Supreme Court cavalierly disregards prior precedent. This is good analysis on stare decisis, right? It says, hey, we're mindful of the fact that that the inverse ratio rule has been the rule in the Ninth Circuit for decades. We get it. We don't lightly come to the conclusion that we should overturn it. But we're going to go through a dozen cases of how it's really, really hard to apply this and it produces inconsistent and contradictory results. And most importantly, we're going to go through the fact that what made sense in 1975 in terms of access doesn't make sense in terms of in 2020 in terms of access. And it really is. It's a good blueprint, because I get asked this question at debates and by listeners all the time of like, oh, well, you're saying stare decisis is so great, but like, you know, Brown v. Board of Education was pretty great, too. And I will say to them, like, yeah, I'm not saying we're always bound by prior decisions. I'm saying that when you depart from a prior decision, you should have compelling reasons for doing so. And they should be more than just, I'm Clarence Thomas and I don't like that other case anymore. And this does a good job of laying that out. So the net result is that the Ninth and Sixth Circuits previously adopted the inverse ratio rule. The Second, Fifth, Seventh, and 11th have rejected the inverse ratio rules. So if Randy California wants to appeal to the Supreme Court, we called our initial conversation on this case Stairway to the Supreme Court, not just because I think you picked that title, not just because it was a great clickbait, but this would make, this is the kind of case that the Supreme Court is likely to take. So we'll know in a couple of weeks if Randy California appeals this decision to the Supreme Court. I have no idea if he, you know, through his estate, through Michael Skidmore, I would think so. And I think the Supreme Court's likely to take this. So
just so they can set the rule straight. Like
so that, right. So that they can adjudicate this conflict between the circuits. And also,
but
given,
just
you know,
as a reminder, even if they win, even if the Randy California estate wins or whatever, because it was on the kind of jury instructions thing, doesn't that just mean they have to redo the whole thing? It's not
as though
they...
exactly right. And that's another great kind of callback to our interview with David, right? Like that if Randy California wins before the Supreme Court, what he will get is a new trial in California. Yeah. That's exactly right. Like at the end of the day, you know, we're still a ways off from, you know, him gaining the, you know, some percentage of a million, billion, right. trillion dollars or, yeah. you know, whatever.
All the money ever.
All
printed.
The money in the Western Hemisphere. Yeah. Yes. So there you
wow.
go.
Well, there's your update. That was a medium dive. I thought that, so they're not exactly a wild card segment, but it's okay. We always make time for our friends in Led Zeppelin.
Absolutely.
great personal friends. Good times. I still have so many questions about all the music case and stuff. We got to keep this going. You know, we'll do more at some
absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely. I love it.
But what we need to do now is thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats here on Top Patron Tuesday. And Andrew, why don't you start us off?
All right. And thank you to Minneapolis Live Show. I'll bring Twins tickets. Well, I think there will be neither live shows nor Twins games for a while. Yeah. But we're looking at it, man. We definitely are. A holding action for your right to party. Beautiful. Samuel Bland, Mitch McConnell's Yodel Mountaintop Removal Service. Ooh. Brian Lehman, wow, this list is so freaking long, but you know, not long enough. And we'll tell you how to get on it. Angry MacFace. And what do we say to Seattle live shows? Not today. Look, we really want to go. This Patreon name is a lot more pressure than I was expecting. Seattle, come for the weed, stay for the quarantine. We hereby invite Silk to join Lionel Hutt's Lot Awful Movies. Yeah, we're getting a Lot Awful Movies to you very soon, I promise. We've had one Super Tuesday, but what about second Super Tuesday? Hell with my inner child. I'm getting in touch with my inner curmudgeon. Ziegenhagen, oi, oi, oi. A row of question marks and what looks like AC, like with an umlaut in the middle. I'm sorry. I'm Who sure knows? This is some kind of ASCII picture, but there it is. Ian Buckley, there's always money in the banana stand. Kristen Daniel, Thomas Smith is the Ted Olson of co-hosts.
Yeah, totally get that one. Nice job.
Airbud Golden Receiver is Michael Fick's villain origin story. Murray Gregerson, Colleen Wilson, Christopher Brown, Lawful Copter, India's shooting students protesting against bigotry. Can we get cert to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3BE answers? Support co-ops and not-for-profits. 34124, no officer with false teeth should attempt oral sex in zero gravity. Another good what Space Corps directive. Oh. Amber Green, Cogdis is my favorite podcast. Oh, it gets more money, which
we are fine with that.
Love. Yeah. Yep. Let me be totally clear. Torres Smith, 2024. Clear eyes, full hearts, totally clear. Zirkle, Freudian faceplant. Barry McCockiter, cat dead. Details later. I hope not. God, that's terrible. We don't. I'm so sorry. Ad Astra survived Max related layoffs. Odin the Law Dog, Emily Rainbow Spence, there's a full moon this Easter, so watch out for Werewolf Jesus, Jason Copas, Man Chicken will happily receive all junk mail on Thomas's behalf.
Oh, wow, let me tell you, bring a crate every single day.
Looking forward to the 2020 Marble Olympics. Thank you, Gels Marble Runs. Hotspear can't fly you to BCN, but can offer lodging and tapas and sangria. Well, you know, all you need are tickets. That's then we'll do. Then we got the quadrifecta. FUCT, a janitor's mind oils, is an anagram of jurisdictional phantoms.
Yeah, but not because there's an F.
Right.
So were they doing P8 anyway? Yeah. I don't get it.
It's legal. Okay. It's advice. It's opening arguments live in Vegas. Michelle Cloud, poop is funny. Poop is in my butt. Ergo, my butt is funny. Nate Drex, spoon feed your kid from the grave because you know they are a clown horn. Stuff and Poles, Darth Mandy Pants, don't forget to drink your daily dose of glyphosate. I don't take that kind of advice from this podcast. I'm Brewing, 13th Century Saxony Gravel Truck Lawyer, Airbud 7, Game Pet Match.
That's good. Right. I like that one.
That
better.
Is really good. That's a quality Airbud pun. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Crying again in my whiskey because I love Elizabeth Warren and now have to vote. Yeah, no, we are too. But yeah. Cry in your whiskey. Get through the stages of the Kubler-Ross model and be prepared to vote for the nominee. Jennifer Kratch, doot, 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 my corona. I'm here because Diogenes the Cynic was right. Time to nude the movel. Spaghetti, the noodle without a moral arc. Steven Balticate Sandoval, shop Jita 4-4. I have no idea what that means. Petitioning the Ministry of Magic for a writ of Mundungus. Matt Gates looks like he got COVID-19 by eating boogers. I heard that he did. So, buy gift certificates from local small businesses in Washington or anywhere, really.
Interesting.
CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio, The Registry Matters Podcast, and John Bilderbeck. Take it away, Thomas.
All right. My pants are too tight. Andrea, the Arbitrary and Capricious, Seattle, home of Westland Distillery, tons of corgis, and OA live shows. Yep, someday. Gerrymandering is abuse of power. Coronavirus might have jumped species from humans to Ted Cruz. Eric Alsman, Warren 2020, Warren 2020, Warren 2020, Payne's Trumpet. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Tramblus, Clownhorn, the live show. I just want dinner in Seattle. Catherine Connell, Napoleon, Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. The Wandering Gambler, if precedence has you down, make it original with pretext. Milo Mead Song stands in solidarity with UW nurses and their union. OA YouTube bonus, who knew Thomas was such a hunk? I wrote that one in.
It's true, though. I wrote it in as well, so wow.
Our first and only favorite karaoke legend, Cosmo Blues. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Joe Biden is blank boxman. Ha ha! Yeah. Oh, my gosh. You're right. That is fantastic.
It's true. Yeah.
I had forgotten about blank boxman, and yes, there's also the meme that said, Joe Biden, mediocre for all, like instead of Medicare for all. I thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
someday this podcasting empire will rule the galaxy. James Cole, resplendent and mostly functional. Adam Costa, no. Chad T, anonymous. J. Aldenwalt, the internal body temperature of Tauntaun is lukewarm. Love it, but I've heard enough times. Maybe change your joke. It was great. Fantastic joke. But now time find me a new one that's as good as that one, because I loved it. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Crying into Thomas's back beard? What? All right. Closing concessions.
Do you have a back beard?
I don't, but okay. I'll take it. Whatever. Holly, the ship's computer with an IQ of 6,000, same as 6,000 PE teachers. Septuagenarian deathmatch 2020. Wash your hands, you animals. Derek, I once accidentally wrote a Creed song while fiddling on my guitar. Yeah. This pod brought to you by the righteous fury of E. Warren. Andrew, what case can I turn to? 867 US 5309. So funny. Big Easy Blasphemy. The Yodeler achieved escape velocity and is now in orbit. Volunteer this summer. Learn more at campquest.org. Rhonda wants an Alaskan live show before it all melts. And our position has been we will wait till after it all melts because we don't want to be cold. Atlantis is my favorite Stargate. Universe is a distant last. Malika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, David in Brooklyn, Soggy Pants, Harry Balzac, Matthew Vernon, Sam Buck, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declaring and Ear Docking, Don't Take Ramp Building Advice from a Podcast, Heather L, Sakashite Maybe Trump Doesn't Know, Shenzhen and Shenzhen Are Different, Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. That's probably true, by the way.
I was going to say, yeah. Nice use of the word maybe on that.
Yeah, maybe. Ian Alley. Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Men Are Trash, But I Am a Raccoon, Alexandra Chalupa, aka Natasha Crunchwrap, Mitchell, would you kindly sub to Zero GP? Yeah, that's right. That's Philosophers in Space. Thank you. WHO lifts corona quarantine on all dogs. Who let the dogs out?
God, stupid. That is so great. That is is the best bad dad law joke we've ever had.
A dad joke of that amount of work put into it is I take.
Oh God,
I agree with that 100%. And yeah. Conrad Michaels, thank you so much, Conrad Michaels, still on top. All right, finally, it is time to hear what in the world happened with his T3BE.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
All right. This is a man-owned land, took out a loan, secured by a mortgage on the land. The man had personal liability on the loan. He then sold the land to a purchaser who assumed the mortgage debt. The purchaser failed to make two installment payments. To prevent default and foreclosure, the man paid those overdue installments. After making those payments, sued the purchaser for reimbursement. Will he be likely to prevail? You picked the answer I could barely say. C, yeah. Yes, because the law of suretyship permits the man to seek reimbursement. And I'm not going to screw around and say suretyship any more than I have to. You are 100% correct.
That's funny.
Let's explain this out a little bit because there's the question of like, why is he
there's the question of why any of this? What is any of this? Yeah. There's a lot of questions, Andrew. There are a lot of questions.
All right. So the man, as the mortgagor, has the personal liability for the loan, right?
Yep.
The purchaser assumes the debt. As soon as the man pays an overdue installment, he acquires the right to seek reimbursement under the law of suretyship. So option A is incorrect, right? You do not have to foreclose in order to do that.
Yeah, what would you be foreclosing? I don't understand.
On the property itself. But so here's the thing. The reason why the man wants to pay the debt is because he still has personal liability.
Right. Despite the fact that it's secured by land which he
no longer
Wouldn't
owns.
You think right. that the bank would go after the land?
You would think, right? Like this is the plenty of law of bar exam questions involve situations that are technically possible but wildly implausible.
Okay. All right.
So but it's 100% true, right? Like so the fact that D is wrong, right? The man's transfer of the land does not discharge him from personal liability.
Yeah. I think that's the one thing that I intentionally got right, I guess. Everything else was just luck, but like I did think D didn't make sense for that reason, so there you go.
Yeah. And so so that's the reason that he would want to pay an obligation on behalf of someone else, and that's the principle of suretyship, which today is like understanding the common law principles are useful if you've got the time machine set for 13th century Saxony. Today it's by and large a principle in insurance, right? When you have a third party that has responsibility for paying the debts of somebody else. Here, the reason you would do that is to avoid a situation where the original, where the bank can come back and collect against you personally. And so in that situation, the law created at common law this notion of suretyship, which says, yeah, you don't have to go through the whole, even though the man is now standing in the shoes of the bank with respect to the purchaser of the land, you don't have to go through the whole like crazy foreclosure process, right, to try and get your money back. Like you can just pay back the debt and then go sue that guy for the money that you spent on his behalf. So I think ultimately you analyzed it correctly and you definitely answered it correctly. 100%
right, everybody.
Yeah.
You definitely understood all that.
Yeah. There you go. Good work.
All right. I win.
You win.
Let's see. I am very curious to step in our time machine, figure out, who got this one right. I don't know. Maybe we'll go with the wrong answer. We'll see. Andrew, hop in that time machine. Tell us who this week's winner is.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas. A lot of folks played along this week. A lot of folks got the answer correct. I thought a particularly short and pithy and correct answer came from Alex Schaefer. That is at @math_professor on Twitter, who writes, Thomas, maybe he sold the land to his kid. It's a family house or whatever, and so he wants to avoid foreclosure. That said, I don't know what the answer is or what surety means, so I'm going with C also. And I loved the math professor's honesty there. And again, absolutely right. There are lots of reasons why somebody who owns a property subject to a mortgage may sell it off, but maintain, but remain liable and would want to pay to avoid foreclosure. So congratulations, Alex Schaefer. Everyone give Math Professor a follow. That is Math_Professor on Twitter. And congratulations for being this week's coronavirus-free winner.
All right, thanks so much for listening, everybody. Stay safe out there. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. All that stuff. And we'll see you on Friday.
See you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.
Brevard County, Florida.
Brevard.
In Brevard County, Florida. Worcestershire, South Brevard County.